Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk, the most fact-driven, unbiased, true crime channel on the entire internet. First on the docket, we answer subscribers' questions about the now joint trial for Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell. Second, why you must be able to take care of yourself. Third, the police officer shot in the Breonna Taylor matter goes on the offensive. Fourth, next time somebody wants to sell you a real Gucci for a really good price, it may be real, but it may be stolen. Fifth, is Barry Morphew's story coming apart? Sixth, words cannot explain how senseless this act of violence was in Las Vegas. And finally, our dumb criminal contestant of the day. Let's talk about it. Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. This is Crime Talk, and my name is Scott Reich. Thanks for joining us. If you haven't done so already, we'd ask that you hit that subscribe button, hit that little bell over there in the corner so that you get notifications of when we go live or put up new content. And as always, hit that like button and leave me a comment below. First on the docket, we're going to answer some subscribers' questions regarding the now joint trial for Lori Vallow and her husband, Chad Daybell. Now, for those of you who didn't see our video yesterday or the actual hearing regarding the motion for joinder that was filed by the district attorney, objected to by Chad Daybell's attorney, that's right, John Pryor. I misspoke yesterday. I apologize. John Pryor is the attorney for Chad Daybell. Mark Means is the attorney for Lori Vallow. I misspoke. I'm sorry. Needless to say, the court granted the prosecutor's motion for joinder of the two cases, which have the exact same evidence that will be presented at trial and the exact same charges that will be considered by the jury for both defendants. Basically, the argument for the district attorney was that this was issue of judicial economy. There's no reason for us to do this twice. There's no reason for the district attorney to be before two different judges, which could potentially result in different rulings on legal issues regarding the same evidence, but as to different defendants. The court ultimately agreed and granted the motion for joinder. It's still unclear as to which trial date will be the one or if a new date will be scheduled. As you may recall, both of the matters had trial dates scheduled, but it's unclear if those work for all of the calendars and all of the witnesses in those two particular cases. What does this really mean? Now, the question asked yesterday by Harry Knows had some really good questions. And if one person has a question, it probably means at least 100 or maybe 1,000 have this similar questions. First question is, can the attorneys work together? Well, the answer is yes and no. Now, obviously, Chad Daybell's attorney, Mr. Pryor, wanted the matters, or at least he stated on the records that he wanted the matters not to be joined. Now, that's an appellate issue in the future. Lori Vallow's attorney, Mr. Means, didn't object and said, yeah, we want that joint trial. So can they work together? Yes, they can, if it is in their client's best interest. Undoubtedly, when they get to trial, they're going to have some tactical decisions as to how they want to handle witnesses and who may want to be the ones to go after the particular witnesses in this case. Obviously, the prosecution gets to have first crack at the witnesses on direct examination, but both attorneys will be able to ask questions of all the witnesses in this particular case. Now, if the attorney that goes first, and that's usually determined by the judge, usually when there's multiple co-defendants, the judge will rotate back and forth. Somebody goes first on one witness, and then they go second on the other. And I've been in trials where there's been as many as five witnesses, and you just keep rotating down the line as to who goes first. And if everybody does a good job when you're up first, the second guy probably has little to few questions to ask for sure. Now, the interesting issue that I think came up, and it's rather clear to me, and Mr. Pryor preserved this issue before the court and says, Judge, there may be some more discovery that's coming forth, and we may want to file for severance, which would basically say, Judge, set us aside. Let's do it separate again. Basically, right back where we're starting right now. The biggest argument for that is there's going to be evidence that it's admissible only as to one defendant, say, for example, Lori Vallow, and it's not going to be admissible as to Chad DeBell, and that the prejudicial effect under Rule 403 would be too great. That, yes, although it's probative, its prejudicial effect is too great, and therefore it would be result in an unfair trial for one of the co-defendants, and in that example, for Chad DeBell. The other issue, and I've said this before, is if you have inconsistent theory of defenses. If both defendants are going to be sitting there pointing fingers at each other and saying, I didn't do it. Say, for example, Mr. Pryor gets up and says, Lori Vallow did it. Lori Vallow did it. My client knew nothing. Lori Vallow did it. Needless to say, Mr. Means probably doesn't want that taking place at the courthouse because then it's literally two people teaming up on one defendant. So even though there's co-defendants, it could change by the time we actually get to trial. That can even change during mid-trial. I've been in trial where co-defendants have been severed out in conspiracy cases, just like we have here, where they do not establish a conspiracy as to all of the participants that are at trial. And that one defendant that is severed out basically goes and starts his own trial anew at a later date. And the next question was from a Katie Bell. Why do we have multiple judges on this particular case? And she also asked, why do they have multiple lawyers? Well, obviously the prosecution has their own attorney. Everyone is entitled to their own attorney because they have their own individual interests to look out for. You cannot represent a multiple co-defendant case and represent all parties. That would be a conflict of interest. That's why everyone has their own attorney. Now, why are there two judges? Well, these cases were filed as separate cases. Instead of filing one case listing all of the same defendants, Lori Vallow and Chad DeBell, they filed them as two separate cases, hence the reason for joinder. Now, the reason why I've seen why they file all these cases as separate cases these days, in my experience, even though they involve all the same people, everyone gets their own case number, is because of the electronic filing system. You can't do it where you list 14 co-defendants and they're all in the same case. I'm not sure why the states have such trouble with their software doing that, because the federal government indicts multiple litigants all the time and it's just in one case caption. But that's why there's two separate cases for the Chad DeBell and Lori Vallow as it relates to the conspiracy to delay the discovery of the evidence. That is why, because they were filed as separate cases, which is why each case went originally to a different judge. When the cases come in, the cases are on a rotating basis. Sometimes they're selected literally next judge up gets the next case. Sometimes if it's an even or odd number case, it goes to a particular judge in a particular rotation. It just depends on how the system is set up there in Idaho. So I hope that answers your questions. Obviously, things are going to hopefully start picking up on this case, and we're actually going to have some legal motion hearings coming up soon. There's some interesting issues as it relates to the search warrants and also motions in limine, which are motions that are going to be filed saying you can't bring in this evidence, Judge, because it's too prejudicial to the case and will result in an unfair trial. We'll see those motions hearings coming up in the next few months, and those motions hearings help frame the case so that the matter will proceed to trial in an orderly and efficient manner. Keep those questions coming. I'll try to answer them. Next on the docket, why you must be able to take care of yourself. Take a look at this video of a Florida woman being ambushed outside of her home, and then a home invasion takes place, and it's all captured on her video. This woman was leaving her home when two men dressed in all black jumped out of a 2019 or 2020 white Lexus. The men appeared to be wearing dark colored, shiny plastic skull masks. The surveillance video shows that the woman being held at gunpoint and forced to escort them inside the home. Additional footage shows that the suspects began digging around the woman's belongings. While the men were inside, a female suspect was caught on a doorbell Ring camera walking up to the front door as well. The female suspect, who also wore dark colored clothing and a hair wrap, opened the door and spoke Creole before closing the door and wiping the handle down with her sleeves. The home invasion burglars took off with about $2,700 worth of property. Now, I could not imagine something more terrifying. Simply leaving your house, your castle, your abode, getting into your car, somebody running up to the door at gunpoint and ordering you back inside. Fortunately, no one was physically harmed, but I can only imagine the emotional trauma that took place for this particular woman. We've said this before, you gotta be able to take care of yourself. And not everybody has or needs or wants a firearm. And maybe it wouldn't even have helped in this particular situation. But what is going to help solve this case? There's video. That's right. Now, if you go to crimetalkalarm.com, you can purchase the SonaSafe system. It's a total do-it-yourself installation. You literally plug it in, fire up the cameras, and you're ready to go. And the sensors on this are amazing. In less than 1 minute of installation time, the SonaSafe puts an invisible layer of protection around your entire residence or business without the use of any wires or sensors. We've all had those home systems where they got the box and everything like that. You don't need this. You literally plug the box in, put up as many cameras as you want, and it literally is controlled on your phone. It's inexpensive, it's reasonable, and it doesn't compare to what else is out there. If you compare SonaSafe to SimpliSafe, Nest, Scout, or LifeShield, we'll see that there's absolutely no comparison. The SonaSafe system is the best. You have to have something that protects yourself. And what do we talk about all the time? They have to be able to prove identification if there's a crime. What's the best way to do that? Video. The other alternative is to have one of these little bad boys. Go to crimetalkoffers.com. The safety siren is very inexpensive, very economical. And guess what? If somebody runs up on you and you're not sure what the hell is going on, what do? You think that maybe would have alerted the neighbors in that situation? Perhaps it would. It certainly couldn't hurt at all. So go to crimetalkoffers.com and get your safety siren as well. Yes, we receive some monies back if you sign up, but I'm telling you, this is stuff that I'm telling you works. These are things that I've learned from practicing as a criminal defense attorney. If people had something that would help identify people and also cause a scene, it's more than likely those people are going to run away. Go to crimetalkalarm.com or crimetalkoffers.com. Get the SonaSafe, get the safety siren. You'll be glad you did. Next on the docket, the police officer involved in the Breonna Taylor case is going on the offensive. Louisville Police Sergeant Jonathan Mattingly has sued Kenneth Walker, the boyfriend of Breonna Taylor, stating that he has suffered severe trauma, mental anguish, and emotional distress on the night that Taylor was killed after officers executed a search warrant at her residence. That night, Mr. Walker, a licensed gun owner, grabbed his firearm and ultimately fired it. He has long maintained that he believes someone was trying to break into his apartment, which he was living there with, or at least spending the night with, Breonna Taylor. And the Kentucky Attorney General, Daniel Cameron, has heard Walker's bullet struck an officer, and the officers then returned fire. Well, Kenneth Walker fired one. The police officers fired 32 shots. Six of those struck Taylor, one being a fatal strike. Walker was originally charged with attempted murder, but those charges were in fact dismissed. Officer Mattingly was cleared by the grand jury of any wrongdoing, and no charges have been filed against him. And Sergeant Mattingly's attorneys simply states that Sergeant Mattingly was shot and nearly killed by Kenneth Walker, and under our legal system, he is entitled to and should use the legal process to seek a remedy for the injury that Walker has caused him. Now, I have no idea what kinds of resources that Mr. Walker has, whether he had insurance under a homeowner's policy or some side of insurance for renters, but I doubt Mr. Walker has a whole lot of money that he can actually pay Sergeant Mattingly. This seems like it's a poke your finger in somebody's eye to get back and basically say, don't mess with me anymore. It is a valid legal claim, and we'll see what a jury ultimately will decide what Officer Mattingly is entitled to, if anything. Sometimes you have to just let things go. Now, next time somebody comes up to you and says, hey, would you like to buy this watch? Hey, would you like to buy a new Louis Vuitton bag, maybe something Gucci or Chanel? And you think, oh, it's probably a knockoff. Well, think again. Based upon the charges coming out of a 22-count indictment regarding stolen property that was heisted from the Kennedy International Airport, it could in fact be real. Then you may also have to think, if it's real, it must be stolen. If it's too good to be true, it probably is. And what's taking place here is that six people, including two former airport workers, have been indicted in connection with two cargo heists totaling $6 million in designer goods. The charges in the 22-count indictment include grand larceny, conspiracy, and criminal possession of stolen property for allegedly stealing and selling designer goods that were shipped to the JFK International Airport in New York. The two main defendants were former truck drivers at the JFK Airport who allegedly used forged documents and their insider knowledge as former airport workers to steal the air cargo. The first heist occurred back on January 31st of this year, and that load was worth about $804,000. A second heist was later repeated back in May, which was totaling $4.4 million. The police ultimately traced both of those individuals and an unapprehended co-conspirator to a shuttered Queens beauty salon that was allegedly used as a stash house for the stolen goods. While the search warrants were being executed, they found some 3,000 Gucci items and more than 1,000 Chanel products that were in fact recovered. Now, if anyone's ever bought any of these designer goods, you can understand how expensive they are. And it seems like just about everyone of all ages has to have one. These little Chanel purses go for about $6,000. And anything with Gucci on it is obviously very expensive as well. I'm not saying it's not good quality. I'm just saying it's very expensive. And if you ever compared a real Chanel to a knockoff Chanel, you can feel the difference. Now, if somebody offers you a great designer product and the deal seems too good to be true, remember, it is. It's probably stolen. And guess what? If you know or should have known that an item was in fact stolen and you bought it, you can be charged with a crime as well. Now, you can also be charged with possessing counterfeit items. Not that you ever see those really enforced very often, but either way, the true goods manufactured by the Chanels and the Guccis have a right to have their products sold at their prices at their locations. Not stolen, not knocked off. So, little word of advice is, if it seems too good to be true, it probably is when it comes to buying really inexpensive designer goods. Next on the docket is Barry Morphew's story starting to come apart. New information is becoming available regarding whether the alibi provided by Suzanne Morphew's husband, Barry Morphew, is really legitimate. Now, for those who do not know, Suzanne Morphew disappeared sometime on Mother's Day weekend. And initial reports indicated that she had gone for a bike ride on the morning of May 10th and never returned. Now, there's never been any concrete evidence or witnesses' statements that say that they actually saw Suzanne Morphew out riding her bike on Mother's Day. The only thing that is certain was that she was last seen alive in the neighboring town of Salida the day before, when a witness reportedly saw her and Barry out getting sandwiches. The police have been very mum about the investigation since Suzanne Morphew's disappearance. Barry Morphew, her husband, has said that he was in Broomfield, Colorado, just down the street from where we are, and he was there that weekend to work on a landscaping job, specifically to build a retaining wall next to the Northwest Parkway in Broomfield. It's a highway. And that's about a three-hour drive from the Morphew home. Now, according to the information that we have, it's believed that Morphew is believed to have left his home for Broomfield in the early morning hours of Sunday, May 10th. Now, that seems a little weird. I don't know about you, but if I had told someone that I was going to go to work on Mother's Day, my wife or the lovely Miss Kristen would probably tell me, no, you're not. And then it's alleged that Mr. Morphew then returned the same day after being contacted regarding his wife's disappearance. That seems fishy in and of itself, just because you got to be there for Mother's Day. Independent investigation by a Fox 21 reporter by the name of Lauren Schraff reports that the Barry Morphy was contracted for the Broomfield job by a company based in Indiana, where he and Suzanne Morphy lived up until 2018. And according to this report, the general contracting company was Garrett Construction, who outsourced the job to EA Outdoor Services. And that company then hired Morphy, who appears to have been working as an independent contractor since moving to Colorado, where he also works as a volunteer firefighter. Now, the president of EA Outdoor Services is a gentleman by the name of Tony Miller, and apparently he is a longtime friend of Barry Morphy. It's alleged that Miller himself hired Barry Morphy for the job, and the report suggests a somewhat lack of transparency as to this particular work assignment. There apparently are no public documents that ever mentioned Barry Morphy being assigned to this particular job. A worker for EA Outdoor Services reportedly spoke to this Ms. Schraff on the condition of anonymity and expressed doubts about Morphy's alibi. This person also stated that they knew nothing about Barry Morphy until after Suzanne Morphy's disappearance. According to this report, the Indiana-based source says that the original retaining wall took place back in October of 2019, but the work was considered to be poorly done. Morphy and his subcontractors were reportedly scheduled to return to fix and complete the job on Monday, May 11th, raising the question as to why Barry Morphy arrived in Broomfield a full day earlier than the work was planned to be done. That doesn't strike me as particularly shocking. If you live 3.5 hours away, you show up a little early. If you're the supervisor, you want to get the lay of the land. It could be completely innocent for sure. We're just being fair. This source from Indiana also states that the work was not considered particularly urgent. The report also states that the city of Broomfield had not issued a special permit for work on the site to be completed on a weekend. Well, once again, just because you show up early doesn't necessarily mean you're going to work on the project. You could be there to get the lay of the land. Now, Barry Morphy said that he was actually working there, I think, when called his coworker to come down when his wife had disappeared, but he sat in the hotel room for several days, not doing any work. And the representative from EA Outdoor Services also told this Ms. Schraff that they do not believe that any work was done on the wall on Sunday. This source also states that there was no reason for anyone to be there on Sunday, Mother's Day, to do that job. And if they're saying that they were there to do that job, that is simply not truthful. There's also some reports that the necessary equipment for the work in May was never actually ordered. One of Barry's contractors told Schraff that they tried to do the work they could on that May Monday with the tools available to them, but acknowledged that it was completely inadequate. And EA Outdoor Services website states that all of their landscaping jobs are monitored daily. When this reporter contacted Tony Miller, the president of EA Outdoor Services, regarding these types of questions, Mr. Miller said only that he had no comment. So, could this just be somebody that doesn't like Mr. Morphy making anonymous claims? Was Mr. Morphy down there for legitimate reasons getting set up for a job? Or was there something nefarious going on? I'm sure all these individuals has been spoken to by the sheriff investigating the case, or at least I hope so. But once again, you have to look at the facts. Is it a sign of something nefarious, or is it something completely innocent? We'll have to wait and see. And as always, Mr. Morphy is given the presumption of innocence and no charges have been filed against him whatsoever. And if the police thought that they had probable cause to charge Mr. Morphy in regards to the death of Suzanne Morphy, they would have done so already. As of right now, there simply isn't enough evidence and he will be presumed innocent. The one thing the Suzanne Morphy case shows us is you just don't know who you're dealing with at any given time. Please, I urge you. One of the things that the Suzanne Morphy case shows us is sometimes you just don't know exactly who you are dealing with. The best way, and I urge you to do this, please go to crimetalksearch.com, sign up for a background subscription service. There's a small nominal fee, but guess what? When you sign up for that background subscription service, you can anonymously search as many people as you would like. And it's going to prepare a report based upon a search while you wait of millions and millions of public records. And it's going to include information regarding emails associated with an individual, phone numbers associated with an individual. You know, you can find out why your spouse has 3 cell phones, why does he have that Gmail account, all those types of things. You're going to get information regarding social media. You're going to be able to find out information regarding criminal histories, civil judgments, property records, you know, foreclosures, and you're also going to be able to find marital records. That's significant. When that person says they have no wife, wouldn't it be nice to know if that's in fact the case, or maybe what happened to the wife? Those are things that you're going to be able to find out when you go to crimetalksearch.com. You'll be happy you did. Next on the docket, words cannot explain how senseless this act of violence was in Las Vegas. This guy, Giovanni Barajas, 20 years old, sounds like a complete punk. Well, guess what he did? He apparently was in a car and he saw someone riding their bike in Las Vegas. And from the car, he was able to push over Michelle Weissman, who was 55 years old, minding her own business on a Sunday morning. That's when this Mr. Barajas leaned from the passenger window from a burgundy van and pushed her to the ground. Miss Weissman was declared deceased at the scene from the injuries sustained in the fall. Now, if there is such a thing as karma, this may be it. As he swung to hit Miss Weissman, Giovanni Barajas also tumbled out the window and skidded on the asphalt for about 150 feet before hitting a traffic light, which killed him instantly. Now, I certainly don't take pleasure bad things happening to people, but this Mr. Barajas certainly had a case of karma coming his way. This was a complete and senseless act. The good news is, from this case, the driver of the van, a gentleman by the name of Rodrigo Cruz, has been charged with 2 counts of failure to stop at a scene of a crash, and as well as a parole violation from a 2016 robbery case that he served prison time on. Mr. Cruz allegedly denied to investigators that he intentionally drove in a way to allow Barajas to shove the woman. He said he didn't stop after his friend fell out of the window because he was scared because he was on parole. He did say that his pal, Mr. Barajas, was always doing stupid things. Originally, the prosecutor thought that they would consider homicide charges against Mr. Cruz for his participation, but apparently the charges are going to be dropped. Now, I get it. People are young. People do stupid things. But if you're going to do something to harm another person, that's just completely senseless. And in this particular case, Mr. Barajas got the ultimate sentence for his crime, no doubt self-induced. That is why when it comes to prosecuting cases, there are crimes of violence, and this is a crime of violence that should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. So although Mr. Barajas won't be there, Mr. Cruz can be there to take some of the heat as well. Next on the docket, our dumb criminal contestant of the day, and then a recap of our contestants throughout the week to see who's going to be the ultimate winner for the dumb criminal contestant of the week. Now, this guy in our dumb criminal contestant of the day is stupid, okay? He has not been officially identified, but apparently he's not so bright. There was a charity fundraiser being held by police officers and firefighters at the Waco Axe Company on Monday night for the family of a 35-year-old by the name of Lindsay Garrett Hale, who is a paramedic and passed away on the job because of a medical event. The event that was being set up was something called Battle of the Badges, and it was attended by several off-duty police officers as well as other first responders. Well, this dumb criminal there in Waco, Texas, didn't catch the hint and probably the bumper stickers, anything along those lines, but apparently thought, wow, this is a target-rich environment. Let me go break into the vehicles and see if I can get anything of value. One of the off-duty officers just happened to be the interim police chief in Waco. Needless to say, when he discovered this dumb criminal going through other people's cars, he got police officers, who are all off duty, ran after the suspect while he was apparently dropping backpacks as well as a trailer hitch he thought he could get away with and was a little too heavy to run with. where he was ultimately apprehended, where he was ultimately taken into custody. The dumb criminal has been charged with theft and evading arrest. Now, my experience is usually when you see police officers, there's usually some indication that they're a police officer, a bumper sticker with the little blue line, lots of firearm stickers on the back, or something that says, hey, I'm a firefighter, since there's a lot of firefighters at the event. This guy is so stupid, he didn't key on any of that whatsoever. So this unidentified individual, we will find out who you are if you are a winner, but you are a dumb criminal contestant of the day. Now, let's do a quick recap of the dumb criminal contestants of the week. And once again, just when you think the competition can't get any stiffer, it always does. Monday, we had James Florant, who called the police saying that there were small aliens that he was seeing and that he was going to go Independence Day on them. Tuesday, we had Mr. Blight, who is going to remove political yard signs using a bulldozer. Wednesday, we had Miss Lander, who is filing fake and forged documents, dismissing all of her criminal cases pending against her. And yesterday, we had Mr. Christopher Vacha. This was the man who blew into the face of the Uber driver when he was told that he needed to wear a mask. When the Uber driver got out of the car, he hit the Uber driver and has now been arrested for felony charges. And today, our unidentified man stealing from cars at a joint event for police and firefighters celebrating one of their own. Please leave your vote below so that we can tally them up and see who wins to be the dumb criminal contestant of the week. And as always, guess what? The winner will be announced on Monday, and they will be entitled to receive, at no cost to them, a Crime Talk mug. Who doesn't want one of these? That's right. You need a Crime Talk mug. And let's face it, we're almost in November. Christmas is almost here. Now's the time to tell your significant other, your spouse, that you want Crime Talk merchandise for Christmas. You need to order now. And guess what? Like most spouses, they're probably not going to think about it until the night before, and that'll be too late. So maybe you need to do it, order it for yourself, wrap it up, and put it under the Christmas tree. And just think, if you have a Crime Talk mug, it's kind of like I'm sitting there with you. If you buy a Crime Talk shirt, it's almost like I'm giving you a big hug. So go to the link below and buy your Crime Talk merchandise. You'll be happy you did. It's good looking stuff. I'm telling you, I wear it myself. That's all we have for you today. Have a great weekend. We will see you next week. And don't forget to watch our recap that will come out Saturday of all the big stories throughout the week. Have a great day. We'll see you next time on Crime Talk.